Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary health care services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dr. Don Berwick, most recently the administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare looks at new social games designed to help the chronically ill. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
Today's bright idea looks at a unique way to use simple smartphone technology to help HIV-positive mothers in sub-Saharan Africa safely feed their babies breast milk without transmitting the HIV virus to their children. At the recent mHealth Summit, which focuses on the ways mobile technology is helping to advance global and domestic health, researchers from the University of Washington, in partnership with PATH, unveiled promising data from a project currently underway in South Africa, where 40% of new HIV infections in children happen through prolonged exposure to breast milk from their HIV-positive mothers. PATH, a nonprofit organization dedicated to maternal and infant health worldwide, is studying a low-cost cell phone-based system which guides the user to flash heat pasteurize the expressed breast milk to just the right temperature to kill the HIV virus without harming the nutritional value of the breast milk. The AIDS epidemic had led to a huge drop in human milk bank donations, which are used to treat undernourished, low birth weight, or orphan children, while at the same time, a commensurate increase in infant mortality due to waterborne illness in remote areas where formula was used. Using a simple phone app from Fonestra that comes with a water temperature sensor connected to a data center, HIV-positive mothers, as well as milk banks, are guided to flash heat the expressed milk to just the right temperature without damaging the milk's proteins. The technology is cheap, portable, and effective. The project's goal? To increase confidence in donated breast milk supplies and increase the provision of breast milk pasteurized through flash heating to vulnerable infants, a potentially life-saving nutrition intervention for infants who are preterm, low birth weight, malnourished, born to HIV-positive mothers, or orphaned. The project has received a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Simple, inexpensive phone apps being used to improve infant health for tens of thousands of at-risk infants? Now that's a bright idea.
Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Dr. Don Berwick, most recently the administrator for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Service. Dr. Berwick is also a professor of pediatrics and health policy at Harvard Medical School. He is the founder of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. Welcome, Dr. Berwick.
Thanks. It's nice to be with you.
Yeah, and it's a pleasure to have you on the show, and great to welcome a fellow native of the great state of Connecticut. So it's good to connect. And as administrator for CMS, you were responsible for a significant chunk of the total healthcare expenditures in this country. You sort of had a catbird seat, if you will. You came into the position as the most sweeping healthcare reform legislation in a generation was being written and signed into law. It's hard to separate all the elements of this complex legislation, but when you look at the key components, expanding coverage, changing delivery, or changing how we pay for care, where's the greatest impact likely to come from?
Well, I can't. The answer's got to be two things, not one. And you labeled them both. The first is it's justice in American healthcare. That's the way I think of it. It means moving, taking a big step toward healthcare as a human right by making sure that people in our country have health insurance. So under this law, 32 million Americans, at least, who lack health insurance now will have it as a result of this law. That's a big step forward for the country. The second part is essential also, and perhaps less understood, which is in order to make healthcare sustainable, we have to improve it. That would be true even if we didn't add these 32 million mm-hmm. people to coverage. But healthcare, it's a pretty broken system right now. It costs far too much, twice as much as in any other country per capita. It doesn't perform anywhere near twice as well. And we know there are lots of quality defects in healthcare, things that go wrong all the time and that add waste to the system. And basically, the secret sauce to actually making healthcare sustainable is to improve it. So my agenda there and the idea behind the law is make healthcare affordable through improvement of care.
Dr. Berwick, you might have been the best known person to the healthcare provider community ever to take over the helm at CMS. And I think it's safe to say that many cheered the arrival of a clinician, a pediatrician, who knew what it was to take care of people in the context of a healthcare system, and who also pulled no punches about how big our shortcomings in patient safety and inconsistency in quality care. And recently, you were quoted in the Times as saying that the people who give the care, the healthcare provider community, have got to be the people who lead this thing forward now. So let me ask you, what's your call to action to the healthcare community? What's the health reform equivalent of the 100,000 Lives campaign that you unveiled when you were heading up IHI?
That's such an important question. I can see now, having been in Washington for a year and a half, how powerful and generative good public policy can be. The new law, the Affordable Care Act, is that. It's a magnificent law, actually, despite the controversy. People don't really understand how good it is. I do now. So it sets the stage. It makes it possible to focus energies on improvement of care and keeping the patient foremost in mind. And we can go into what those mechanisms are. They're technical mechanisms. But what they really do is create a space, an opportunity, support for people to give care, to improve the care they give. I think they really want to do that. Most doctors and nurses and hospital leaders, they want the care to be great, but things stand in their way. Now a lot of those barriers are gone. But the fact of the matter is nobody really can change the care unless the clinicians, the professionals, and the people that organize care do it. Who else could? I mean, the buck stops with them. So here's an opportunity. Can we work together as an entire nation of professionals and caregivers to address the opportunity for care improvement? That includes things that make care better directly for patients, like safer care. You know, we now know how to eliminate a lot of infections. Let's do it everywhere. If one hospital's eliminated central line infections, mm-hmm. let's just make that the standard and everybody do it. If one system has reduced pressure ulcers 95%, which is true, Ascension Health in the Midwest, when everybody can do that. The same goes for continuity of care. We know how to craft much better journeys for patients with chronic illness, you know, smoothing the way in inside and outside hospitals. Well, to do that, we have to change information systems, habits, training, become teammates, you know, better teammates. All of that lies with the healthcare professional. So the call to arms, to action there is, let's make care better. Let's commit as a nation that the best care anywhere will be the care everywhere. Now, part of that is cost reduction. I don't think I would choose this to be the mandate if we could do otherwise. We can't avoid it anymore. Healthcare just plain costs too much in this country, and there's going to be only two ways to get costs under control: a bad one and a good one. And the bad one is cutting stuff, just taking things away from patients, limiting benefits, denying insurance to some people. You know, it's a really bad move, shifting burdens onto patients who can't afford them. I don't like that idea, but it's going to win because of the economic pressures unless we choose the other way, which is to save money by making care better. Mm-hmm. That's up to us.
It's sort of a dual agenda of we've got to make it safer, improve outcomes, but also just pulling the thread on it costs too much. And you've made the point before that we could perhaps save 20-30% of our expenditures. And you've outlined that waste comes in a lot of forms: duplication, needless tests and treatment, but also complications that could be prevented, admissions that wouldn't have happened if there were a better primary care provider available. And the list is long. A signature accomplishment at your time at CMS was the release of the Accountable Care Organization legislation. You wrote the rules and you rewrote them, and the final versions were really widely embraced. What will the accountable care organization mean to a patient? What's their role in all of this? And just who and what is accountable to the patient to ensure that care isn't sacrificed to cost?
Yeah. Good question. Well, back to the premise. The way to get care to be affordable is to get the waste out of care, and the best people to do that are the people that give care. So waste comes in many forms, but probably one of the big ones is failures of coordination of care. And every doctor, every nurse, every patient knows what that feels like. It's when they can't remember your name, when your problem list doesn't move around with you, when doctor number one prescribes a medicine that shouldn't be given with a medicine prescribed by doctor number two, when someone with chronic illness goes home from the hospital and bounces back in 6 days because they had a complication that nobody detected. All of that, everyone knows what failures of continuity and coordination look like. So there's been a move toward a form of care, the Accountable Care Organization, which actually is a pretty interesting idea. It's to encourage primary care providers to band together to take care of populations of patients over time and space. But the patients don't lose any choice. They still can go anywhere they want. They're just normal fee-for-service Medicare patients. So now this group of providers that said, well, we'll be accountable for their care, they've got to now act through attraction. They have to be such a great place to get care that patients choose to stay there because they can feel the continuity. If they manage to offer continuous care, avoiding readmissions, reducing complications, and so on, well, costs will fall, and the Accountable Care Organization gets rewarded because it can share in the savings if the cost for care of the population is less than was predicted over a year. So they share in the savings. So the ACO is watched closely. There are 33 quality measures. Several of them include direct feedback from patients. We're going to be watching quality really closely in the ACO, so the only way they're going to be able to save money is by improving care. If care gets worse, they won't save any money and they won't share in anything.
Dr. Berwick, it's been so sobering to note reports that as Medicaid costs rise as a percent of state budgets, the budget share that can be allocated to education is falling proportionately in some states. And you know, of course, that the health of a community tends to rise directly in proportion to the level of educational attainment, so we don't want to see this happen. But Medicaid has such big challenges, the cost of long-term care for the elderly in nursing homes, the cost of folks who are under age 65 but who are disabled and poor and on both Medicaid and Medicare. It's also, though, an area where there's so much innovation going on at the state level in the state Medicaid plans. What are some of the promising areas of innovation at the state Medicaid plan level that came across your desk while you were heading up CMS?
A lot excited me. Better systems of coordinated care, getting especially dual-eligible patients into really effective coordinated care systems that keep them home where they want to be, hiring healthcare coordinators and others that really, really help people understand what's going on with them and staying healthy. I also was really intrigued by innovations in telemedicine. There are several projects, not just in the Medicaid realm, offering consultations to primary care providers from university bases. There's a wonderful program called the ECHO program in New Mexico that's just fantastic. It's projecting technical care support to primary care providers all over the state. I see lots of opportunities for using remote monitoring and for remote consultation. So, and for Medicaid populations, that's crucial because these are largely people with chronic illnesses.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Donald Berwick, who recently stepped down as administrator at the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. You know, Dr. Berwick, I want to take you back to a famous speech you gave over a decade ago, Escape Fire, and you told the gripping story of 13 young men who were killed fighting a fire in Montana. The leader of the group, Wag Dodge, now you couldn't make up a name like that, survived by starting an escape fire, essentially creating an opportunity to find a route to safety. And now this was risky and dangerous and unexpected, but it saved his life. In your speech, you talked about the importance of sense-making in a critical situation and the essential qualities needed to change old patterns and adopt effective ones, and really about effective leadership. Now, how has your work at CMS advanced developing new leaders that can lead healthcare and help the country escape the fire, which I think you've described as really a poorly performing healthcare system?
Well, the story of Wag Dodge is that he invented a solution and tried to get the other people to get into the escape fire area to save their lives, and they didn't. They ran right past it and got killed. Mm-hmm. In healthcare, we have answers. We have solutions. There's great programs all over the country. And we can't run past them. We have to say, hey, wait a minute, if they know how to do it, we all should do it. CMS now has tools for doing that. It has both incentives, making it more interesting financially for places to invest in better care. It also has the ability to help people learn about what's new, what's possible, through the Innovation Center, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. And before I left, we introduced the Innovation Advisor Program, which will support scores and soon, I hope, hundreds of people around the country who will be in relationship with the Innovation Center from their home base and will learn what's new, what's coming along that they can adopt and use locally.
Dr. Berwick, I'm glad you mentioned the Innovation Center because I have to tell you that I think your time at CMS ended just as you were about to have some real fun in the middle of all that hard work that you were doing. Like just about everybody in healthcare with drive or creativity, we're very aware of the Center for Innovation call for creative ideas that offer real evidence they can reduce cost, improve quality, improve the care of patients. And the CMS Center for Innovation has $1 billion appropriated under the Affordable Care Act. Some big ideas. Give us a sense of kind of ideas that you think will come pouring in, and what would you be really excited to see?
Well, first, the Innovation Center has $10 billion.
Oh, excuse me.
It's the largest national investment in innovation in healthcare that we've ever seen. It's really, really exciting. Yeah. And it's already issued a number of calls for proposals around Pioneer, accountable care organizations, bundled payment demonstrations, federally qualified health centers, advanced primary care. There's tremendous stuff going on. The most recent $1 billion solicitation was for sort of like any ideas that have the effect of reducing costs while improving quality quickly. And I think we're going to see thousands of proposals coming in. There are inventors all over the country. Some of those will be in the telemedicine area that I mentioned earlier. I think there's great opportunities there. And we need much better ways to develop teams and coordination of care for chronically ill patients in very local settings. I think we'll see new job roles emerge as we think about how to help people through their journeys in care. We're going to see lots of inventions around new roles for people to help them learn how to stay healthy. And I've seen some of those around the country already. They're pretty exciting.
Now, a new proposal on Medicare was released the other day by Representative Paul Ryan, a Republican, and Wisconsin Democrat Senator Ron Wyden. And I'd say it's more of an outline. The plan would set up a competition between traditional Medicare and regulated private insurance plans. Now, the White House has panned the initiative. Any initial thoughts on this?
You know, I respect the people that propose that are trying to come up with new ideas, but I have not studied those proposals particularly, so I'm going to have to hold my comments till I've studied them further.
Sure.
Dr. Berg, we've heard a lot of concern over the last several years voiced about our country's ability to meet the demand for primary care, healthcare in general, but particularly primary care. Both when 40 million Americans get health insurance, but even today, we certainly heard about this in Massachusetts, and I think they turned out to be well-founded, particularly in the more rural western area of the state. Now, the Affordable Care Act addresses primary care shortages in a variety of ways through training and through incentives to attract more people to primary care. But I'd like to ask you, one, do you think we're turning the tide with regard to the shortage of primary care providers? And two, is it possible that there's more efficient ways for fewer primary care providers, our physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, to take care of more people?
Yes and yes. First, understand you're talking to the son of a primary care provider.
That's right.
We know. The father of a primary care provider. So, you know, this is close to my heart. All strong healthcare systems are founded in primary care, not just physician primary care, but nurse, advanced nurse practice, and other roles. Yes, I think the tide is turning. There are more incentives now toward becoming, under the Affordable Care Act, toward primary care. I think that everyone is aware of this as a problem, and I think we're going to see more and more progress toward primary, increasing the attractiveness of primary care as a discipline. But the other point is equally important, leveraging the time of those who want to give primary care so that they can take care of more people more effectively and with more joy in their own work is very important. That includes new roles. I always worked, for example, nurse practitioners. I never saw patients without a nurse practitioner helping me, and I know the value of non-physician roles in supporting more effective primary care. And this is, by the way, also supported by the new wave of exciting work to help patients and families take more responsibility for their own care. You know, really, why would we make people helpless? Instead, we can give them tools to stay healthy, to monitor their own physiologic status, their own medicines, to be more active participants in care, and that'll leverage primary care too. So I'm optimistic. It's going a little too slowly, but I think we're going to see acceleration.
This is Conversations in Healthcare. Our guest is Dr. Donald Berwick, former administrator at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. You spent a lot of time trying to change the framework of how people think about the payment system from volume to value. Talk to us a little bit about outside of government, beyond the Medicaid and Medicare payment, what's happening in the private commercial sector or what are employers doing to help create that change?
Well, a lot. One of the constant sort of frustrations at Medicare for me was for people to perceive Medicare to be somehow outside the American healthcare system, in, you know, kind of its own thing, but it's not. It's a stakeholder in the whole system. So happily, what we're seeing is a lot of the same innovation that's occurring in the Medicare, under Medicare auspices, it's occurring perhaps even faster in the private sector. So lots of insurers are now experimenting with new ways to pay for value, not volume, for outcomes more transparently, and to reward organizations that achieve better health for their populations while containing costs. The alternative quality contract from Blue Cross Blue Shield in Massachusetts, which has become quite well known as one such form, but by no means the only one. There's lots of synergy between the federal payer, Medicare and Medicaid, and the private sector moving toward paying for what we really want, which is health and better outcomes, not just for spinning the wheel.
Dr. Berwick, it's been very exciting over the past year to see many elements of health reform in motion, certainly watching the 20-somethings stay on their parents' policies and how much the rate of uninsurance has fallen in that group, the expansion in Medicaid in some states, increased public health funding, and, of course, the work going on building the health insurance exchanges. But that threat is still out there in front of us that the Supreme Court could find the act unconstitutional, particularly the individual mandate. Now, forward progress is hard to stop, but if that fell, if the individual mandate fell, do you think meaningful reform can still move forward?
Oh, definitely. I mean, first of all, I don't think the law will fall. I think it's constitutional. Everything I heard when I was in government makes me optimistic that the Supreme Court will find that this was a properly constructed law under the Constitution. That said, the movement toward a better healthcare system, I think, is unstoppable now. We really have no choice because we're headed for a cliff. Unless we find a way to make healthcare better and affordable at the same time, our country's in much more serious trouble than it is now. So I think we're headed for healthcare change no matter what. I don't think the repeal or disabling of the Affordable Care Act is a good idea. It's a terrible idea. It's a tragedy for the country as people lose the kinds of coverage you were just referring to. Insurance companies begin to get away again with withholding coverage from people with pre-existing conditions and so on. I think we'll be smart enough as a public to realize that we need to keep this law in place.
Dr. Berwick, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
All over the world, healthcare is at last discovering the same connection between quality and cost that other industries discovered decades ago. There's a misperception in healthcare that in order to have the care we want and need, we have to pay an ever-increasing share of our commonwealth. I think that's not true. As in all other sectors, better care and better quality is the best route to lower cost. And when we mature as an industry and realize that, and when professionals lead it, we'll have a solution.
Today we've been speaking with Dr. Donald Berwick, former administrator for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services and a leader in the fight to bring innovation, quality, and safety to our healthcare system. Dr. Berwick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We close with the Tech Report. I'm Marianne O'Hare. Michael Ferguson is part of a growing sector in the healthcare arena that you wouldn't ordinarily link together. A so-called serious game studio, his company Aogo is part of a new tech sector that designs social healthcare games that seek to engage chronic illness patients to interact with others in the same boat.
If you meet this health goal, you will earn this currency, this virtual currency that you can spend in a game to do something that's fun among you and your friends.
Ferguson says gaming may seem like it's geared towards the younger generation, but the industry is finding otherwise. Ferguson says the metrics bear out their theory. Those who are challenged by other players to socially engage in a competitive challenge are 3 times more likely to respond and take on the challenge. That's astounding for healthcare systems seeking to engage their patients in their own health outcomes.
That's Marianne O'Hare with this week's edition of the Tech Report. If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.